Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much stuff does it take to allow one to live well? And do you actually need to own the things you use, or might it be enough just to have access to them when you want it? Practitioners of collaborative consumption are aware that the planet can't sustain 7 billion people who buy and use as much as the typical American. But rather than suggesting we give up all comfort and convenience, collaborative consumption encourages us to consider access to certain material goods as desirable as ownership, weakening our attachment to things even as it strengthens connections among people. Beth Baczynski is a freelance writer who specializes in environment, technology, and sustainable design issues. Her new book is called Sharing is Good: How to Save Money, Time, and Resources Through Collaborative Consumption. Beth, welcome to Think.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit more about what's called the sharing economy.
Sure. Well, sharing economy is a newly emerged term, and it basically refers to a lot of the new platforms we're seeing emerge for providing access to things rather than owning them, just like you mentioned. So we're seeing platforms like Zipcar for car sharing, and we're seeing Airbnb, which allows people to access different types of lodging, alternatives to hotels and motels and things like that. So the sharing economy encompasses collaborative consumption, but I think it's also a term that we're using to indicate a social change, a change in values, a change in the way people decide what's a need and what's a want and how they go about fulfilling those things.
And in some ways, this is a return to how humans have lived for a very long time. There is a long history of collaboration, even as a driver of evolution.
That's absolutely true. It was really cool to learn while researching the book that cooperative behaviors were really rewarded in the development of early societies, and you know, being able to rely on the community to help provide for your needs instead of just being an individual kind of in it only for yourself was very helpful in terms of protection, in terms of gathering the resources that we needed to thrive. And I think we continued that into early bartering culture, where we used the things that we already had or had access to sort of trade with others and get the things that we didn't have readily available.
And bartering is great, but of course it requires that I have something that you want.
Yes, absolutely. The coincidence of wants. So this is great when you're maybe in a community of 12 people and it's easy to just kind of go around and figure out what people have and what you've got that they might want. But it's a lot harder in the society that we have now. And, you know, we're very much oriented around convenience. So if something's going to be really inconvenient or too hard or take too long, that's a big barrier to participation. So what we're seeing now are these new sort of systems emerge, leveraging the technology that we've got, this awesome mobile technology that's in everyone's pocket, to sort of give us access to a much larger community and to make it so that we can share what we've got when we have it and then go to that same platform and ask for things when we need them later, and it doesn't necessarily have to happen all at once.
How did we develop the sense culturally that lending and borrowing was something to be avoided and in fact that it might even be shameful to ask other people if you could borrow things?
You know, it's difficult to say exactly when that sort of shift came about. I think, you know, post-World War II, in the kind of abundance that we had after that in terms of manufacturing and the cheapness of goods and everyone being fairly well off in terms of money or able to get the things that they needed, we started developing a sense of purpose and self around the things that we had and the niceness of them and the modernness of them, et cetera. And so I think it's just continued as we've become more focused on consumption and sort of become really skeptical of the people around us. I think everyone can kind of tell that neighborhoods and don't really operate the way they used to. You know, it's not as easy to just go knock on a stranger's door and ask for a cup of sugar. We have these barriers up because, you know, our trust has maybe been betrayed or we're really skeptical about the things we hear in the news and we project that onto our own communities. So I feel like it's real easy to see sharing as a threat to that. It's something that's very unfamiliar, and it definitely requires that we open ourselves up to new experiences and maybe even new people. Hmm. So it's definitely something we need to get used to in that regard.
I was interested to read, Beth, that the number one sort of roadblock that people name that keeps them away from this is that they worry they don't have enough time to do all this.
Yeah, well, time is a big one. You know, like I mentioned before, we're very oriented around convenience. We like things to be delivered to us. We'll pay to have it shipped faster, et cetera. So, you know, when I talk to people about sharing, it's not only a new concept to them, but then they realize that they might have to work with someone else's schedule, or they might have to, you know, wait for something that they want to appear on a swapping website rather than being able to have it immediately. So time is definitely one where it can kind of give people pause. At the same time, if you participate in certain types of sharing and collaborative consumption, you can actually save a lot of time. So it's kind of just weighing the newness of it versus the potential benefits.
And of course, there are businesses who worry that this too much of this behavior will hurt their profits. But you name a number of different businesses that have actually found ways to earn money this way.
Yes. Well, you know, there's a couple different ways this can work out. Businesses that are struggling or trying to maybe expand or do something new but don't have access to the traditional means of capital for that are being really successful through crowdfunding, which is, you know, Kickstarter and Indiegogo, platforms like this that allow people to donate $5, $10, $20 to a cause or a project they really care about. And that can actually make a big difference for local businesses. I think about in my community here in Colorado, there was a small two-screen local movie theater that was going to have to close their doors because they couldn't finance the shift from analog to digital film. And they actually ran a very successful crowdfunding campaign, rallied the community around them, and they were able to make that shift and continue to be a profitable business in the community. There's also examples, which I found surprising initially, of actually businesses sharing with each other. This could be something as simple as data and information, maybe collaborating on a marketing campaign, all the businesses on a block getting together to try to kind of elevate the visibility of all the businesses involved. Or, you know, actual literal bartering between big companies where they don't maybe have the cash, but they can use stock that's not being used to kind of gain access into new markets.
So when I'm sharing with a neighbor, I just want to make sure that I'm going to get back my, you know, table saw or hair dryer or whatever it is without it being broken. And this turns out to be something that keeps people from wanting to engage in this.
Sure, it's just circling back around to that same trust issue. And for sure, humans are clumsy, we make mistakes, we have accidents, and some of us, you know, are selfish in a way that would actually, you know, harm someone else in terms of like stealing or something like that. And those things have occurred in the sharing economy. They're far and few between when you consider really the huge number of people that are participating in this lifestyle globally. And so you just have to seek out the services that are doing a good job of creating policies up front for how to handle disputes or accidents when they occur so that everyone knows who's responsible for what. And there are resources if you want to share, you know, at the neighborhood level, you just want to be able to lend out your tools to someone safely. There are great resources for maybe writing up a set of rules or writing up a contract so that everyone involved knows exactly how things are going to work.
And I guess it's interesting because social media allows us to sort of scale up the neighborhood level sharing so that, you know, if I broke the neighbor's lawnmower, everybody would know that Chris broke the lawnmower and don't lend her anything else. It's the same way if you go online because your name gets a reputation.
Absolutely. So right alongside the sharing economy growing as its own thing has been, you know, the explosion of social media, and it's been great to see how the two have been able to sort of assist each other in leveraging our social networks. So if you have a lot of connections and if you participate in, you know, like Airbnb often and you get a lot of good reviews, that's building social equity under your name that can then be leveraged to encourage other people to share with you. You know, when I look at Airbnb, I'm considering staying somewhere. I definitely put more weight on the listings I see with, you know, 100 positive reviews rather than someone who's maybe just started. They've only had two people stay. They're really short reviews, and it doesn't tell me much about them. So social media has been a great way for people to leverage the networks that we're building constantly online into sort of a reputation for themselves in these new platforms.
So let's talk about some of the ways that people are doing this. There is just person-to-person sharing. There is online person-to-person sharing. And sometimes these are set up so that, you know, I might give something this week and not need anything for 4 months, but then I can come back and see if anybody will help me out.
Yeah, so a great example is Yertle. I don't know if you guys have heard of it. It's an iPhone app. And it's out of San Francisco. And what they've done is their motto is sharing is the new shopping. So they've literally created an app that makes it easy to browse categories just like you would on Amazon. But you're looking at things that people potentially in your area, you know, are just willing to give away. And when I've used Yertle before, you know, I've given several things in a row, and then maybe a month later I'll go on and then browse for something. And what Yertle's done is made it so that you earn a virtual currency for every time you give something away, and then that is used to sort of bid on the items that you want when it's time for you to claim something from the community.
And I guess we've all been in that place, right, where you really don't want something in your house anymore, but it's way too good to throw into a landfill.
Yeah, absolutely. And even donating, you know, donating to thrift stores and sort of dropping things off at Goodwill, that's something we're really familiar with. And I tell people that sharing those goods or using collaborative consumption services to give those away instead is very similar, except it's more purposeful. When I give something away on Yertle, I exchange a couple emails with the person that's going to get it, maybe a phone call. If they're in my area, I might actually meet them at the coffee shop to exchange these things. And so it's just another step towards developing a relationship, kind of getting outside of our little internet bubbles and meeting each other again and realizing that we can look at the people around us as resources and that people are often very willing to help.
What about surfaces? How are people exchanging these? It's a little bit different from moving away from material consumption, but it is part of this sort of sub-economy that we're talking about.
Sure. Well, there's a couple different ways that works. One of my favorites is skill sharing. There's a great platform called Skillshare.com, and anyone can get on it and create an online course, anything from web development to gardening to cooking. You can be someone who does this thing professionally, or it can just be a hobby, a passion of yours. And people are signing up for these classes. They're a couple of weeks long. They have a definite project that you'll be able to, you know, a deliverable that comes out of the other end. And, you know, for about $20, you can take a class on your own time schedule and really learn something from someone that really cares about that and is invested in you taking that skill home. And it's a much more accessible way for people to learn these things. If it's, you know, from a high school student that can't get that class at their school, or someone that doesn't have time to take it at a community college or money to do so, it's a great alternative. And then with regard to actually making money in that way, there's a service called TaskRabbit that you might have heard of, and there's a lot of similar services. And basically, it's micro projects. It's hiring people in your community for something that might take a few hours, whether it's putting together a bookcase or grocery shopping for you or picking up your dry cleaning, whatever it is. It's these small gigs that people can, you know, they bid on. They say, I'll do that for a certain amount, and you have the knowledge of giving, you know, a few bucks to somebody who's in your community trying to make an alternative income, and they have the ability to string together a bunch of these gigs to really make a significant income.
And again, you're able to sort of rate people and how the experience went so that they can either improve their performance, or you can if you're providing the service, and there's some provenance to people who join these services.
Absolutely. Certainly people that are participating frequently and that have, you know, all positive reviews, they definitely enjoy an elevated status in the community. They are often in demand. And, you know, when you have a good experience with someone, you want to use that person again. Just like if I stay with someone through Airbnb in a city and really loved it, if I come through that city again, I'll probably want to book with them again. So again, using that social equity to sort of build a clientele for yourself.
My guest is environment and technology writer Beth Baczynski. Her new book is called Sharing is Good: How to Save Money, Time, and Resources Through Collaborative Consumption. We'd love to hear from you on this, how this might be part of your life in some form. Give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. Send a tweet to @ChrisBoydThink or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer Beth Baczynski, whose new book is called Sharing is Good: How to Save Money, Time, and Resources Through Collaborative Consumption. You can join the conversation, talk about how you have been a collaborative consumer at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Beth, talk a little bit about the ethics behind this, because as you mentioned, our greatest fears about our things being destroyed if we happen to lend them out tend to be a bit overblown. But there is also, we all have to have a sense of responsibility and caring for things that belong to others.
Sure. A lot of people ask me, what's the best way to be a successful sharer? And in addition to, being flexible and keeping an open mind, I also, just say to be good people, be the type of person that you want to be shared with. Be trustworthy. Be honest when you're listing things on these sites. Be honest if something happens and there's been an accident and you need to get it taken care of. I think of a really cool story from the peer-to-peer car sharing platform Getaround. There was someone who rented out someone else's car, took it to pick up paint and some supplies at the hardware store, and ended up having a can of paint explode in the trunk, red paint all over the trunk. That could have been a disaster for everyone involved. But not only was Getaround, not only did they have a structure in place for supporting when, disputes or accidents happen, so the person that rented the car knew exactly who to call, they knew how to get in touch with the owner, and, by the time the car was returned, it had been totally detailed. There was no paint in the trunk, so it's often really an opportunity for people to rise to the occasion and show just how caring and compassionate they can be with our things.
And the more organized of these web services do, in fact, often they'll offer things like insurance or require you to pay for insurance. Certainly with an automobile, that's an issue. But a lot of them have ways that help you work through these issues so that everybody's protected.
Absolutely, especially when it comes to the sharing of the bigger ticket items, cars and, our houses. With Airbnb, that was one of the most high-profile cases where someone's house was vandalized by someone who had misrepresented themselves on Airbnb in the first place. And, that prompted immediate action from the industry. Airbnb now has, I think, $1 million insurance policy that comes along with signing up to be a host on the website. And that's just automatically there so that you can know that your things, your space is protected if something like unexpected like that occurs. And the peer-to-peer car sharing platforms are another great example. Relay rides, people get into car accidents and, there's a question right now whether that should be something that can be covered under your personal insurance. So Relay Rides just takes the guesswork out of it and they supply their own policy for while you're using their car that way.
Let's talk about all these car sharing services because it's fascinating to me, to sort of read the things in the newspaper and elsewhere that young people are not as interested in owning their first car as I was, 20 something years ago, closer to 30 years ago. It's not such a big deal anymore. Teenagers don't necessarily dream about owning a car. They just want the freedom to get around.
That's true. I think in some ways the self-expression and the sense of independence that we used to get from the car owning has now been transferred to smaller technologies. It's the iPhone instead of the car now. And that's the way that we stay connected and how we communicate and how we, express who we are, or through more of these online platforms. So I think that's the case. And more of us are living in cities than ever before. And there's something to be said for not being a car owner in an urban setting. You don't need to worry about parking. You don't need to worry about insurance. Just the high cost of ownership is, I think, not attractive to a lot of, people in the younger generation who are coming up and maybe dealing with some employment issues, some security issues that the older generation didn't have to. And so, we're starting to be more interested in just being able to get where we're going and not necessarily have to have that be in our own car.
So I've been in a number of cities where bicycle sharing is available, either for a small fee and you swipe a card or you're simply able to borrow a bike for free. I always wonder, though, how it works for people who ride a bike to their destination and then lock it up in the provided space and then come out and there are no more bikes left.
Yeah, that's true. So a lot of these schemes are set up for just for the short distances, right? You ride it, you pick it up at a bike rack that's near your work, you drop it off at a bike rack that's near the grocery store. So that's definitely maybe a drawback of not owning in that sense, is that you can't often take these home with you or use them for an undetermined amount of time. One way that you can get around that, sort of, especially when you're traveling, if you want to, you know, see a city by bike, but you want to be able to have that at the hotel with you or whatever, is peer-to-peer bike sharing. Hmm. There's a platform called Lyft. I think it's called Liquid. And it actually facilitates, just like you would with a car, the renting of your bike. So if you know that you're going to be working all day, or you take the train to work and your bike sits in your garage, you can make that available to someone who's traveling through that city and wants to use a bike.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone out to David in Grapevine. Hi, David.
Hi, how are y'all?
Great, thank you.
Good, great show. The topic y'all are talking about reminds me of something I've been thinking about in the past few years. I've been mowing my lawn, and it occurs to me that it's kind of strange that I own a lawnmower, an edger, and all that equipment, and I use it, you know, 3 hours a week, 8 or 9 months out of the year. And this, it seems like that'd be perfect for neighbors to co-own and co-use. So I'm wondering if there's any resource you know of regarding lawn equipment specifically, and also the impact on the manufacturers and repair and all the other people in the distribution of those products.
Great idea and great questions. Thanks, David.
Yeah, that is a great question. So the big tools and appliances are constantly used as examples. I love telling people, you know, we all have a power drill in our garages or our basements. The average power drill is used about 20 minutes during the entire lifetime that it's owned, you know, and we all have one of these. So that's a great example of just how we have all this idling capacity in our possessions, and we could really, by, you know, making those accessible to other people, really take advantage of that. To speak to a resource for doing that, there's a platform called snapgoods.com, and they are unique because they specifically focus on lending rather than the permanent giving away of things. And they have some great, repair and replacement policies in place there so that you wouldn't have to worry about maybe drafting those up on your own. And, you know, you could also make a little bit of income renting that out to other people in your area who need one.
We should make a distinction here, because there might be people who say, well, I'm not doing a lot of borrowing and lending, but I am buying green. And your sense is that the problem with the green economy is that it's still a form of consumerism, even if we're trying to choose things that are better for the environment.
Yeah, so this is a hard place for me, because, you know, being a sustainability blogger, I talk a lot about new cool products that are coming out that are so much more environmentally friendly than what we have, and, you know, encouraging people to take advantage of those. And it's hard, because at the same time I realize there are lots of things in that vein that even, you know, I can't do. I don't have solar panels on my house right now. You know, I still drive a car. So there's something to be said for the accessibility of that, as well as, you know, we're still kind of thinking that we can buy ourselves out of some of these problems, and I just really don't think that that's possible. I think the attitude of consuming to solve problems is what got us into many of them, and in some ways it's out of the reach of a lot of people. You know, organic things are expensive, fair trade things are expensive, and you know, not all of us can participate in that way, and I just don't want people to feel like there's nothing for them to do to support the kind of world they want just because they don't have the money to buy these green things. I think sharing provides a great and more accessible alternative.
I am no fashionista, but it sort of made me smile to realize that for people who are, you can carry the best designer handbag and wear a really fantastic dress to your event and not actually have to purchase these things.
Oh my gosh, these are some of the coolest ones. There's a website called Rent the Runway, and it really is just a way to temporarily have access to, you know, these very fashion-forward dresses, accessories, all these kind of things, things that you would never want to sink several hundred dollars into. But if you really want to look your best for something that's coming up, you can borrow it for just a couple days and for a fraction of the cost. And you can do that. There's platforms to do that with accessories. I think one called Bag, Borrow, or Steal, which is a really clever name. And then, you know, again, there's platforms that exist for helping people do that just on a peer-to-peer level. If you have a great closet, but you're not wearing all those clothes all the time, there's a way to share it.
And this is really different from the old, like, guys rent their tuxedo. There's a wider selection of styles.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've just been astonished. I get the newsletters for some of them, and they're just crazy. They go with the seasons. It's everything that is the most couture, and I'm no fashionista either. But if you are into that, there's definitely a way to do it on the cheap.
Well, I will say one of the best things I ever did when my kids were little, I was part of a clothing exchange for children, like at our preschool. And it was such a money saver, and everybody loved it. And I wonder why everyone who's got little kids who grow out of stuff every 3 months doesn't do this.
Absolutely. For growing families, clothing swaps and toy swaps are a great way to kind of reduce the amount of that stuff that builds up in your closets and also to save money. That can be extremely expensive to clothe a growing child. And why not take advantage of the families around you that have kids or just a little bit older or younger and make use of that? There are, again, you know, online platforms for doing this in a way that can be profitable. One that's really great is called ThredUp. And it's basically an online consignment store for, you know, gently used, high-quality kids' clothes. You can put them on there, and people that are looking, you know, for the best at a lower cost can take advantage of it.
And once again, you know, when you, I suppose, send off some clothes, if you've sent stuff that is stained and full of holes, you're going to hear about it, and maybe people won't take your offerings next time.
Absolutely. ThredUp in particular has a very clear and strict policy on what they consider quality and not. I believe they will probably, one advantage of using a platform like that is they will probably send it back to you and say that it's not acceptable. And again, everyone gets reviewed. The experience, the transaction is out there for people to see how successful it was. And people can see the quality of stuff that you're sharing if it makes it onto the site. And that's, again, a way to build your reputation.
Can you tell us about yard sharing and how that works?
Sure. So yard and garden sharing is really cool. It's the idea that a lot of people now are interested in growing their own food, but especially for people in urban areas, the space is lacking. We don't all have the huge yards where you can do that easily, or even live near a community garden where that could happen. So there are platforms like hyperlocavore.com. In the UK, there's landshare.net. And specifically in the Seattle area, there's a site called Backyard Barter. And what these do are basically connect people with the space, but maybe not the skills or the time to use it as a place to grow food, with the people who are, you know, really eager to be gardening but don't have that space. So again, it's just a really easy way to connect people that can benefit each other. And usually when that happens, you know, the person who donated or allowed the space to be used, they get a share of the harvest for nearly no effort. The people who are growing the food and doing a lot of the work get the gardening experience and get the food without having to buy that plot of land. So it's really a mutually beneficial situation.
Sounds like a lot of this stuff is, particularly what takes place locally, it's going to require you to form some new relationships, right? Maybe you can send off your clothes to a person in Minneapolis and not notice really what's going on. But if you're working with someone to share your yard or to go into theirs, you're going to get to know them.
Absolutely. You know, at its core, the sharing economy is about people, and it's about the power of people and what we can do together. And I think that it's one of the biggest benefits is really this rekindling relationships, especially in your sort of local neighborhood city. You know, being able to talk to the people around you again, getting to know them and their lives and their challenges and what they're going through. And maybe you start by just sharing a garden, but you're going to learn a lot about that person. And maybe you realize there are other ways where you can benefit each other throughout life. And so, you know, mutual interests and all these kind of things, issues that you're passionate about might actually, you know, spring into some kind of activism. So there's just a lot of different ways where just being around each other again and working towards common goals is going to be really beneficial.
You make the point in the book that these kinds of setups also allow lower income people to share in some of the things that were historically only available to those with more disposable income, which I think is a great point. I wonder, though, if people don't have to fight against a sort of classism where you would lend stuff to someone who seems like they might live in your neighborhood, but maybe you would feel differently if somehow that wasn't the case.
Sure. I think that that's a valid point. You know, again, sharing is forcing us to challenge a lot of these, you know, notions that we've built up over time about who and what is safe and familiar and secure. And, you know, on one side it does. Libraries and cooperatives and things like that have been a great way for people to, who might not otherwise have access to technology or even food and clothing and things like that, to kind of band together and benefit from each other in that way. But we do have these ideas of what's safe and what's secure, and certainly those can trickle into this. You know, if you only want to share with people who are just right in your neighborhood, that's probably going to limit, you know, not only the amount that you have access to, but the amount of joy and benefit that you get out of the process in general. The more open of a mind you keep and the more people you're willing to kind of bring into your sharing circles, you know, it just exponentially increases the experience for everyone.
We should say that libraries, I mean, obviously are pioneers in this sort of thing, but are these days a lot of libraries are lending far more than just books.
Yeah, libraries have become great hubs of the sharing economy. You know, they are one of the oldest examples, obviously. And then there are, you know, as we make this shift to more digital, and maybe coming to get a book isn't the reason why people come to libraries anymore, they are making their space and their resources open to other types of sharing. We've talked about tool libraries. In many communities, the library itself is the location of the tool library where people come to get different things. I've seen baking sort of tool libraries where it's pots and pans and dishes and things like that for people that want to maybe bake a cake or something like that. And I've also seen libraries become co-working spaces. Co-working is really close to my heart. That was my first experience with the sharing economy, just, you know, a shared communal workspace for people who might otherwise, you know, be stuck working in their kitchens or in coffee shops, independent workers. Libraries are opening up, you know, their back rooms and their conference rooms to people that need a place to come and, you know, plug into the internet and kind of get together and work with other like-minded individuals.
Environment and technology writer Beth Bozinski is my guest. Her new book is called Sharing is Good: How to Save Money, Time, and Resources Through Collaborative Consumption. If you have a question or maybe a story to share about your own experiences with things like this, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer Beth Bozinski, who writes about clean technology, sustainable design, and environmental issues. Her new book is called Sharing is Good: How to Save Money, Time, and Resources Through Collaborative Consumption. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Next on the phone here, we have Eric on the line in Dallas. Hi, Eric.
Howdy, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
Good. Also wanted to make mention of the burgeoning number of hacker spaces and maker spaces. For those who aren't aware, it's like a shared workshop where nerds and geeks primarily, but really anybody can come in and build and make and create whatever they want to. We have a large one in the Dallas area, of which I'm a member. The largest one that I'm aware of is in San Francisco, the name of which escapes me at the moment. But it's another one of these shared tool library knowledge thing. I've learned a ton at the makerspace just building and creating stuff that I never would have thought about making before.
Are you talking about like art stuff, Eric, or like home projects, or what exactly are people working on?
All of the above. The Dallas makerspace in particular, we just acquired a CNC plasma cutter. The pride and joy of the space is a laser cutter. Many members are into 3D printing. Several members have made their own 3D printers. We've got folks who are building furniture. We've got art projects. We've got a biospace where somebody's doing biology and project like that. there's all sorts of things that are done at these spaces. And Dallas isn't alone. There's one that just opened in Abilene that I'm aware of. Again, San Francisco is the largest one that I know of. Really neat places for people to just go and build and create.
It sounds fantastic. Thanks so much for your call, Eric. Have you heard about those, Beth?
Absolutely. I'm so glad that that was mentioned. Being really involved in the co-working scene as I am, hackerspaces are sort of like our cousins in this effort of sort of bringing people together in the same space to kind of, do the things that they're really good at, but then also to benefit from just kind of rubbing shoulders with other people who are good at other things. And hackerspaces and makerspaces are so cool because they do provide hobbyists and inventors, access to these big time machines and equipment that you wouldn't otherwise be able to have.
Okay, so I thought it was also brilliant. You write about these services that allow people, once they have finished their video game and completed the mission or whatever, to trade those with somebody who might not have played that game.
Yeah, media swapping is a great way to get involved, and probably one of the easiest ones. Again, you're done with this thing. You don't need it anymore. You had the experience of it, so you don't need the disc sitting on your shelf any longer. So there are, different swapping sites like Bookmooch and similar things for paperback, CDs, video games that just make it easy to kind of swap that with someone else who's got a game that you want, or, just to kind of trade it away and then wait for the time when something that you want appears on the platform.
It's interesting that while ebooks are really green in many ways, they don't make it easy for you to give away something you've read to another person.
That's true. It is a lot harder, but not impossible, to share an ebook. There's actually a platform called Lendl, which is still kind of in the early stages, but it's kind of a combination of lending and Kindle, and that facilitates, the sharing of Kindle books that you've already read. You can lend them out electronically for maybe a month or 2 month basis, and then at the end of that time, it comes back to just your ownership, and that person can't access it anymore. In fact, now that I'm thinking about it, there may be a way that you can actually do that through Amazon. I feel like maybe through Amazon Prime, you can gain temporary access to books and then avoid paying the full price of them. So there are ways to do it. You just have to look around.
And there are lots of places now, or at least some places, where you can rent college textbooks, which makes so much sense because nobody really goes back to them. Or I'll speak for myself. I never went back to mine after finishing school.
Okay, so this is one instance where I'm totally jealous of my younger brother, who's in college now.
Mm-hmm.
We have a difference about 10 years between us, and he absolutely takes advantage of textbook rental services, even some that are electronic, whereas I had to cough up the big amount of money for the textbooks up at the front end and then worry all semester about how little I was going to get back for those when I sold them back. So, yes, online textbook rental has been great for kids to be able to access these textbooks on a temporary basis, for a lot less than they would have had to at the bookstore. And, you can even mark them up in the same way that you would have, and it's an easy way to kind of keep those redistributed.
You can also find online people who have done a craft project or gotten out of that medium and have a lot of stuff left over that they want to share.
Yes, this was a really cool thing that happened with a blogger friend of mine, writes for the site Crafting a Green World. And, she's very active in all different kinds of crafting and DIY, and started to notice just a backlog of, bits and ends of things that she hadn't used for projects, kind of building up in her closet. And rather than just kind of throw those all away or donate them all away, she got onto her blog and created a forum where people could list what they've crafting supplies that they've got that they're not using anymore, or crafting supplies that they need, and just sort of reach out to each other and help fill those needs.
You also included in your list, and we should say there's a great sort of, it's not even an appendix, it's just the end of the book is filled with a listing of all the services that do multiple things. You have Craigslist down there, which people might not think of in this respect, but in fact is probably one of the leaders in repurposing used items.
Right. Craigslist, FreeCycle, many of these platforms existed long before we started using the term sharing economy, and were an easy way for people to kind of just, virtually put up a sign in their yard and say, here's the things that I'm just willing to give away, free stuff, come and take it. And those platforms are still thriving, absolutely. And some free cycle networks especially are very active in people circulating stuff between them. And, you know, the one drawback for some people is that they are a little bit on the anonymous side. You know, Craigslist does have a little bit of a reputation of sometimes you don't know kind of what you're getting into with either the person or the item. So in some ways that can be, you know, maybe a little a hesitation for some people. So these newer alternatives where you do have, again, the reputation building aspects are a little more attractive. But indeed, Craigslist and FreeCycle have been doing it for a long time.
Are there particular services for people who might need to hire temporary workers? Is this part of this kind of economy as well?
Yeah, so back to what I might have mentioned earlier. So TaskRabbit, GigWalk, AirTasker, these are new services that have emerged to really allow people to leverage their time into a really valuable resource. So you can go onto these platforms and either put a task that you need done, and it, again, it can be something really simple, or, you know, actually temporary employment, and find people in the community that are looking for these micro gigs. And some people have been really successful in turning this into full-time jobs. They get up in the morning and they, you know, bid on the gigs that they want to do that day, and they just kind of piece together an income that way.
We have an email here from Mary Kate who wants to know where this is going on in the North Texas area and how she would find people participating. I know that there is obviously Craigslist here and FreeCycle. And Beth, are there good ways to sort of investigate within the local community to see what's taking place around here?
Sure. Well, I know that both car sharing and bike sharing are big in North Texas, so I know you guys have that on lockdown. The easiest way to do it, and it seems so simple, but is just to Google whatever type of sharing you're interested in and then your town. So if you're interested in toy sharing or toy swap, just kind of Google that in your area and see what comes up. The alternative to that is looking on meetup.com, where people kind of get together and put groups together on whatever topic is of interest to them. I've had a lot of success in just kind of looking for collaborative consumption meetups in a certain area, and that will often show you who's interested in that topic, who's talking about it, and probably be your first step into, you know, the smaller neighborhood level communities that are interested in getting this stuff going.
I'm glad you explained that, because I think people might hear meetup and think, oh, it's a dating site, but it's not.
No, it's not. No, actually, meetups can be really useful, especially if you're moving into a new area. You know, you can look for meetups, you know, if you're into craft beer, if you're into knitting or something like that. There are meetups for just about anything. So for collaborative consumption and sharing, they can be a good start.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Kobe in Dallas. Hey, Kobe.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I worked in the music industry for about 15 years and no longer in that industry. And a big part of it is, or was, that it imploded. And a lot of file sharing of music, a lot of burning CDs, that really, really, you know, crippled the industry, along with, you know, other things we did, which wasn't necessarily good. But I just have a moral issue, an ethical issue with file sharing and sharing books, like you said, or sharing music, I should say, music and games, because the artists do not get paid. And that's, you know, that's their revenue generator. So for me, it's just a real issue. And but here what you're, I guess I said.
I'm glad you brought that up. Thanks, Kobe.
Yeah, so that's a good point. And, you know, anytime we're sort of seeing a shift in an economic shift, or, you know, a change in the construct of how we conduct trade in a certain way, there's going to be that rub. There's going to be some loss. And it's going to be hard for some people. I absolutely don't condone any sort of illegal file sharing or piracy or anything like that. You know, you definitely want to make sure that the thing that you want to share, whether it's music or whether it's a book or whatever, is yours to do that with, and that you're doing it in a way that that is on the up and up. And there are different ways that it can benefit people and not benefit people. And I think someone earlier, the caller, mentioned about manufacturing. That's a big concern for people, that if we share everything, then people who make things are going to be out of a job. And you know, there are some things that are really conducive to sharing, and I think are the easiest things to share. There are some things that I probably won't ever share, you know, like your toothbrush and underwear and your dishes and things like this. We will always need some things to be ours and only ours. And I think that, you know, managed fleets of things like we see with Zipcar and other stuff like that, you know, they still need to repair and replenish those fleets from time to time. It'll be a lot slower than the rate of consumption that we have now, but I think there's still a place for that.
Well, and I totally sympathize with the point that Kobe made. On the other hand, there are a lot of artists in a lot of different areas who are benefiting from things like crowdsourced funding.
Absolutely. Crowdfunding has been huge for anybody in the arts, especially musicians, you know, who don't want to waste however many years of their life waiting to be noticed by a label. They just want to put the music out there. They probably have the online fans already that are just itching to have it. And in some ways, you know, they've started to give away digital music. And, you know, some artists say, you know, we're going to put this out there for free and you give us back what you think it's worth, or, you know, you donate to us so that we can continue to give this to you for free. So some are embracing it and it's been really successful.
And the way that many of those platforms work is that an artist puts out a proposal and lets everybody know that it's there. And then you say, if this comes through and actually happens, I will give you X amount of dollars, sometimes in exchange for an autograph or a CD or a painting or that sort of thing.
Right. So there's often a reward for donation model. So with Kickstarter, people are pretty familiar with. Yeah, you'll go on and you'll view a project page and they'll say, here's who we are. Here's what we want to do. Here's a really detailed breakdown of how we want to use this exact amount of money that we're trying to raise. And you say, okay, I think that that's a worthwhile project. I want to see that happen. I'll give you my $50. And often there are donation levels. So you know that if the project comes to fruition, if they raise the amount of money that they're aiming for, that $50 will get you an advanced copy of the CD or a signed print or something like that. So there are some really cool perks that can be gotten with the technology that's coming out through crowdfunding platforms today. Sometimes you gain access to really cool gadgets that no one's going to have for a while.
You write here about microfinance, which is an interesting aspect of this. We think about it as the kind of program that works in the developing world, but it's happening elsewhere as well.
Yeah, so microfinance or microlending is just simply peer-to-peer lending, being able to kind of make these small dollar amount loans to, you know, a regular person just like yourself that's looking to raise money or to get a better interest rate or something like that. And indeed, we're seeing them used here. There's a platform called Prosper that you could actually finance a car through or take a personal loan for maybe a medical expense. And, you know, there's just a number of different ways that you can do this. It's at a cheaper rate than maybe a bank would offer you, or maybe the bank wouldn't approve you at all, but you can get it through this platform. And, you know, the person donating the money gets kind of that good feeling of knowing they're helping someone achieve something that they need or want, and they get a small return on their investment, and then they can turn around and do it again.
One of the most important things you say that we need, Beth, to start engaging in this kind of sharing is a sense of adventure.
I think so. I think you've kind of got to be ready for something new. It's not gonna feel the same as shopping. It's not gonna feel the same as other things you've done before. You need to really kind of be flexible and see where it takes you. But a good way is just to start small. You know, start with that thing that's you've just been dying to get out of your house and see if you can share it instead of just giving it away. And once you kind of see how it works and you get comfortable with it, you'll start to realize that the benefits are really huge and maybe move on to bigger things.
Beth Baczynski is a freelance writer who specializes in environmental, technology, and sustainable design issues. Her new book is called Sharing is Good: How to Save Money, Time, and Resources Through Collaborative Consumption. Beth, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. We had Christina Martinez helping out on the phones today, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd's Think, and you can contact the show via email anytime at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.